From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. A report out today is stirring up new controversy over one of football's most controversial subjects, head injuries and their suspected connection to dementia and mental impairment. The survey was commissioned by the NFL. The retired players who were questioned had a particularly high rate of memory-related diseases, as NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
The University of Michigan's Institute for Social Research conducted phone interviews with a random sample of 1,063 retired NFL players. The interviews happened in November and December of last year. Researchers asked the players a wide range of questions, including this one. Has a doctor ever told you you had some memory-related illness? 6% of players 50 and older said yes. 1.9% of players between 30 and 49 said yes. The 1.9% is 19 times higher than the national average.
The remarkable aspect of this study is that it's a study that they commissioned.
They, says neurosurgeon Dr. Julian Bales, is the NFL, the same NFL that has, in recent years, discounted any outside studies, including Dr. Bales, showing a link between retired players and brain problems.
We told them this 4 years ago. It's fully in lockstep with other results. My opinion, ball's in their court about how they want to react.
So far, cautiously. While acknowledging it commissioned the report, the NFL warns it's not hard science. An NFL spokesman wrote in an email, the survey did not diagnose dementia, but relied on self-reporting by retirees or their family. The survey's lead author, researcher David Weir, also noted that the numbers being reported as alarming, particularly the incidence of brain illness in 30 to 49-year-old retirees being 19 times higher than the national average, that figure, says Weir, is based on a very small sample of respondents.
That total amounted to a total of 9 people in our study, so it's hard for me to conclude there's a 19 times elevation on the basis of only 9 people being observed. And again, all they told us was a self-report. They'd been told they had this problem.
Still, the study recommends further research based on the results, and according to an NFL spokesman, that kind of research already is underway. The league's Medical Committee on Concussions has an ongoing study of retired players and the long-term effects of concussion. That committee includes a controversial character, Dr. Elliot Pellman. He used to lead the committee but removed himself from that position because of negative press. Pellman had been critical of outside brain injury studies, like the one done by Dr. Julian Bales. And Pellman, in the past, had stated that returning to play after a concussion did not involve significant risk of a second injury, either in the same game or during the season. That contradicted reliable research and experience by other experts and former players. The NFL's ongoing study is due to be completed in a year or two. In the meantime, the controversy over football head injuries and suspected long-term brain problems continues. In recent years, there have been disturbing reports of former NFL players with Alzheimer's disease, severe depression, and even those who committed suicide. Critics of the league say the NFL has tried to play down the issue because of the bad publicity it creates. The NFL vehemently denies this. According to the league spokesman, there is more research and more knowledge of concussions today, thanks to the leadership of the NFL. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The vast majority of classroom teachers are trained in traditional colleges of education. Lately, that training has come under intense scrutiny. Critics say too many of these graduates are poorly prepared for the enormous changes taking place in the real world of American public schools. As part of our new year-long series on making teachers better, NPR's Claudio Sanchez tells us how colleges of education are responding to the criticism.
At Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Professor Leela Christenberry's methods class is immersed in a discussion about intrinsic motivation.
The question that we have is, if your students do not manifest intrinsic motivation, do not want to be there, when does the bell ring? No, I didn't bring my pencil. No, I didn't do my homework. No, I'm not going to open the book.
So what do you do, Christenberry asks? Well, offering pizza points would be a big mistake.
And I think it's going to hit you again as you sit in your practicum school, just how many things can you do to entice your students? There was a hand up. Yes, Danny.
The options for motivating students these days, Christenberry tells her class, are really limited. She covers a lot of ground in this two-hour class. There's a group presentation covering eighth grade history standards and how to teach them, followed by teaching high school literature, what works, what doesn't. In classes like this, students also hear a lot about what VCU professors call the hidden curriculum, showing children love, respect, and compassion. Shay Robinson, a first-year grad student, says it came in handy when she was student teaching and was assigned to a troubled little boy.
He was kicking and throwing and beating up his backpack, and the teacher asked him, why was he doing that? And he said, I can't beat you up, so I'm going to beat up this backpack. And then they said, oh, Shay, you're going to be working one-on-one with him in the hallway. And I thought, really?
Robinson says those lessons, combined with her special education training, helped her deal with his child. She traced his anger to a situation at home, and by the end of the year, he was doing just fine academically. Real-life classroom experiences, says Professor Kristenberry, that's what the curriculum at VCU is based on.
I went back to teach high school English because I was concerned about being out of touch. And when you go up and down this hall in this school of education, you're going to find people who are in the schools every single week. We're not out of touch. Every person is a veteran elementary, middle, or high school teacher.
But Kristenberry knows all too well that some education professors are clueless about kids and just about everything else that happens in classrooms these days. She once taught at a university in another state where students were baffled that some of their professors had never set foot in a school.
And they came to my class and they said, Dr. Kristenberry, what do you think about that? And I said, it's criminal. It's criminal.
It's that disconnect that makes Arthur Levine want to blow up some colleges of education and start over.
Education schools have, in many cases, become irrelevant and often of very low quality.
Levine is the former president of Columbia Teachers College. He spent the last 5 years studying what he calls the crisis in the preparation of classroom teachers.
The curriculum at schools of education has little to do with practice, what goes on in schools. There's a gap that's a mile wide. Senior professors don't participate in schools. There are universities around this country that place their students for student teaching in failing schools with failing teachers. That's a major problem.
And there's more. Levine says there are too many schools of education, about 1,300, and no more than half are accredited. Only a few produce quality research. Their admission standards are too low. Levine says schools of education have looked so bad that alternative teacher training programs like Teach for America have been able to claim they're much better at producing effective teachers.
Teach for America makes teaching sexy. It gets very bright people who never would have considered teaching to become teachers.
But, says Levine,
there's no evidence or very little evidence indicates any alternatives are any better than the university-based programs.
The bottom line, says Levine, is that if schools of education don't improve teacher training, they should shut down. Bad idea, says Rick Hovda, dean of the College of Education at San Diego State University.
I don't believe that getting rid of colleges of education is the answer to how do we improve. I think figuring out how everybody becomes part of a solution is a better way to think about it.
The solution, says Hovda, will come from programs like his, which has worked to reinvent itself. Unlike VCU's five-year degree program, San Diego State requires that students major in math, science, history, or some other academic subject before they embark on a one-year teacher preparation program.
Now, think about that. We're working with people, preparing them to be a professional teacher in 12 to 15 months. It's not a very long period of time. However, most of that time is spent in a school, in a classroom, working alongside a mentor teacher and a faculty member from the university.
What's unrealistic, says Hovda, is to expect new teachers right out of college to be flawless their first year, especially if they start in a financially strapped school system that can't afford to mentor or support them in years 2, 3, 4, and 5. In San Diego, Camille Zombro, president of the teachers union, says she has surveyed teachers and found that it doesn't matter how good their college training was, many are still unprepared and overwhelmed.
I was stunned by the amount of paper-pushing, mind-numbing, meeting someone else's requirements. That's what's pushing people out the door. It's not the kids. You know, it's the frustration. 50% of teachers are turning over within the first 5 years. I mean, yikes!
And yet, you don't get the sense that students at San Diego State or Virginia Commonwealth University have serious doubts about becoming teachers.
I always cry when I talk about why I want to be a teacher. My name is Megan Williams. I am 22.
Williams says for her, teaching is a calling, not just a job. And what she hasn't learned in class at VCU, she's learned firsthand from working with real school children.
I've been in the classroom since I was a freshman. So when I graduate, I'll have 5.5 years of teachers in the schools that I've been to critiquing me, my professors critiquing things. And I think teachers, you know, maybe 10 years ago that are still teaching, they might not have been as prepared, and they don't really know that.
This kind of self-examination, says Arthur Levine, is what schools of education should be doing, a lot of. After all, he says, they're preparing 90% of the nation's classroom teachers.
Before abandoning them, I would make a serious effort to invest in them and produce the kinds of changes that are necessary to improve teacher education.
For all the criticism that he's leveled against schools of education, Levine says he's committed to helping them, one program at a time. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel. At the Empire State Building, management has gotten into some trouble for plans to illuminate the top floors with red lights tonight. The lights would honor the 60th anniversary of Communist China. Protesters turned out to denounce the illumination. But red is not the color of most interest at the Empire State Building these days. It's green. As Lara Pellegrinelli reports, the building is getting a $550 million environmental upgrade and renovation.
Even before the Empire State Building opened in 1931, its main attraction for sightseers was somewhere up above the sidewalk.
Already, she's higher than any other building in the world. And when she's finished, she'll be 102 stories.
But there are new reasons to linger on the ground level besides the line for the observatory.
All observatory guests, please use the revolving doors.
Specifically, the celestial mural. The collection of golden panels runs across the ceilings of the entire lobby.
It was an urban legend. Those preservationist historians knew that it was there, but the general public had forgotten about it. It was covered over for 46 years.
Jeff Green is the president of Evergreen Architectural Arts. A team of artists from his studio started their work to restore the mural by removing a dropped ceiling that had hidden it since the early 1960s.
The World's Fair was coming to New York. People wanted to modernize. They wanted to improve the light levels. The Chrysler Building, they just stuck downlights right in the Edward Trumbull mural.
Whatever Green's team found in the Empire State Building's lobby was in even worse shape. It had been riddled with holes and covered in layers of white paint. They stripped small sections and eventually hit gold leaf.
Knowing what it was made out of didn't tell us what it looked like.
Luckily, the metallic surface under the paint held a small electrical charge, enough to attract dirt and patterns that outlined the design, almost like a magnetic drawing board. What they discovered was suns, moons, and stars stylized to look like cogs and gears, a celebration of the machine age designed by artist Leif Neandros. Under the sterile UV lights and the old white ceiling, the lobby's gray and pink marble corridors used to look a little like cold roast beef. Now they conjure up a champagne cocktail.
It looks like they're doing just a wonderful job, and I'm not one that often says that.
Lisa Kersavage is Senior Director of Advocacy and Public Policy for the Municipal Arts Society, a century-old organization that fights for intelligent urban planning, design, and preservation. She points out that construction-related debris accounts for 60% of New York City's waste stream, and she wants to change a popular misconception, that it's better to demolish old buildings and erect new green ones.
About 55% of New York City's building stock was built before 1940. And what's important about that is that pre-1940 buildings were built before the era of cheap energy and also before the era of mechanical systems like air conditioning and heating. And so they were built to work with the environment better than later buildings.
Take the Empire State Building's windows.
Windows tend to be the first thing people want to change when they want to do an energy retrofit. And there's so many ways to repair and improve the efficiency of existing windows instead of throwing them into a landfill. It's really important in terms of the efficiency, but also in terms of the architectural character of the building.
So the Empire State Building Company decided to refurbish its 6,500 thermopane windows. Anthony Malkin heads the company.
We're taking them out, we're breaking the seals, we're inserting a Mylar sheath, and then we are resealing them with krypton-argon gas and reinstalling them. All of this will be done without the windows ever leaving the building.
Malkin says the windows and other upgrades will result in a nearly 40% energy savings. And he's promised to share the new techniques developed during the restoration, with the majority of New York's greenhouse gas emissions coming from the construction and operation of buildings. That could help other architectural gems have a golden future, whatever the color of their lobby ceilings. For NPR News, I'm Lara Pellegrinelli in New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. General Motors announced today that it is shutting down Saturn. The decision comes after auto retailer Roger Penske ended talks to buy the brand. Frank Langfitt, who covers the auto industry for NPR, joins me now. And Frank, Penske had been talking to GM for months. A lot of people thought this deal was in the bag. What happened?
Well, Penske's plan fell apart. Now, here's what he was trying to do. He wanted to buy a brand and a distribution system. He wanted to get another foreign manufacturer to actually build the cars and put them under what they called the Saturn badge. Well, today Penske came out and he said the manufacturer's board of directors voted it down. Now, he didn't actually name the company, but he found himself in this position where he was trying to buy a distribution network, but he didn't have anything to distribute, so he just walked away.
Now, GM said in a statement that it's going to wind down Saturn. What's going to happen?
Well, GM isn't really giving a timetable, but obviously it's going to be shutting down manufacturing lines for the Saturn vehicles. It has agreements with hundreds of Saturn dealers. They're going to get some compensation for this, I'm sure, but it's not going to be anything like the money that they sank into the land and the buildings in the beginning, a lot of them in the 1990s. Obviously, a lot of dealers, a lot of those employees are going to lose their jobs, the people who work at the dealerships. And the dealers, really, they had hoped Penske was going to save them, and they're really kind of the big losers in what happened today. GM did say it will continue to service Saturn vehicles and continue to provide parts.
And so for the Saturn cars left on those dealers' lots, what happens there?
Well, they haven't been selling really well anyway. You know, the brand has been under a cloud for a while. And so I suspect the prices are just going to keep falling until they can sell them all.
Now, getting rid of Saturn was part of a massive restructuring of GM that included bankruptcy last summer. Frank, how did jettisoning Saturn fit into that plan?
Well, what GM was trying to do is really slim down. It was a company that was way too big. It had too many divisions, too many brands. It was confusing to customers, and it cost the company a lot of money. What the United States government essentially did is force them to make these changes that they couldn't do on their own, and with, of course, $50 billion of our tax dollars. So getting rid of Saturn, they got rid of Hummer. Pontiac is being shut down. So this was one more brand to make them sort of a much slimmer, more competitive company.
But here's the funny thing, Frank. I thought Saturn was the brand that customers loved when it came on the scene in the 90s. It was a sensation. It was designed to save GM. What happened?
Well, you know, you remember they built that plant in Spring Hill, Tennessee. They had those really cute commercials. Mm-hmm. They had a family, you know, barbecue picnic that people came back for. And in the beginning, they put out these reliable sedans to compete with Toyota and Nissan and Honda. And they had this no-haggle policy. Customers really liked it. And for a while, it was working. But there were other problems. It did cost billions of dollars to fund this. A lot of people who analyze Saturn think it may have never actually made much money. Then GM got strained with the financial crisis in the 90s, didn't give any new product to Saturn, and so over time, the brand kind of lost luster, customers, and really, in a sense, it never recovered. And so what they had was a brand that really wasn't helping them and basically kind of lost its way.
Okay, that's NPR's Frank Langfitt. Thanks so much.
Happy to do it.
Frank, with the news that General Motors announced today that it is shutting down Saturn.